This season, let your shoes do the talking. Designer Shoe Warehouse is packed with fresh styles that speak to your whole vibe without saying a word. From cool sneakers that look good with everything to easy sandals you'll want to wear on repeat, DSW has you covered. Find a shoe for every you from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, New Balance, and more. Head to your DSW store or visit DSW.com today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Into the 9 o'clock hour we go, fully loaded, but I gotta tell you, first of all, the password to register to win a pair of tickets to the second weekend of Jazz Fest, and it is gumbo. That simple. Don't miss your chance to win. All you have to do is listen at 9, noon, 3, and 6 for the Jazz Fest code word of the day to see amazing artists like Pearl Jam, Luke Combs, Lenny Kravitz, KG Elephant, Santana, Patti LaBelle, Trombone, Shorty, and more. So I've given you that code word, gumbo. You go to WWL.com/contest and register to win, and bada boom, bada bing, you're done. It's that simple. So we'll have a word for you every day at 9, noon, 3, and 6 for the second weekend of Jazz Fest. And I've already congratulated our previous winners, Bruce Wyatt of Kenner, Jason McGinn of Metairie, Harry Cabraceras of Covington, Kristen Jones of Marrero, and Chris Miller, not our Chris Miller, of Metairie. You could be the next one. Just go to WWL.com/contests and enter today's password, which happens to be gumbo. All right, we're joined now by Darren Detweiler, Associate Teaching Professor at Northeastern University. Talk about food safety and food recalls in the country. How you doing, Professor?
Great. Yourself?
Real good, sir. We've had you on before. It's a pleasure to talk to you as always, and I would like to open the Oakland on Jeweler talk and text line here. Text and message rates, I don't know, might apply, whatever you need to know. And don't text and drive, 504-260-1870. If you have any words about different types of food, any questions are out there about different types of food or food poisoning or recalls, etc. Professor, one thing I wanted to start with DOGE and the FDA cuts, how important is it, and I guess we'll start with context, how important is it that the inspection process in the United States, and how does it compare with other countries in keeping what we eat and drink safe?
Well, first off, there's multiple levels of challenges. And while I'm always supportive of the idea of efficiency and improvement, I'm concerned about the idea of making certain changes, cuts to funding, cuts in terms of staffing and eliminating certain roles and losing experts in this when we're still driving down the freeway at full speed, if you will, in terms of food safety. It's not like we're taking a pause in terms of the foods we eat and the foods we bring into our border and the foods across state lines. So it's a very complex system in the United States, perhaps more complex than in most other developed nations, in that we say things like America has the safest food supply in the world, but the reality is we have probably the most complex in terms of the fact that it's not just like one nation. It's not even 50 states. Many states are divided into different jurisdictions. We have essentially, when you start looking at military bases, you start looking at tribal reservations and protectorates, we have about 3,000 different jurisdictions when it comes to food, if you look at food safety and regulatory authority. So controlling all this is very important. Obviously, efficiency and effectiveness is important. It's been talked about for a long time. We have significant gaps and a lack of uniformity across these jurisdictions, and even at the federal level. There's 15 different federal agencies that play a role in this. So in terms of your question specifically, I think there's change that needs to be made. My biggest hope is that it is true change and that the process of making this change does not put consumers in more danger in the meantime.
How do you, you know, as you say that, what pops into my mind is how do you draw the distinction between redundancy and waste? Because sometimes there is a need for redundancy, right?
We definitely have a need for redundancy. There is, so we talk about things in terms of the farm to table, but we don't look at, for instance, farm to hospital or even beyond the hospital in terms of things. You, like, if you, you've heard news, like, remember last year we heard the news about the Boar's Head outbreak and mm-hmm. how 10 people were killed? And McDonald's, remember how McDonald's had the onions mm-hmm. that were contaminated in certain places? Well, the same time they announce these things, they'll say things like, well, the people that got sick, their illnesses reported, 6 or 8 weeks ago kind of a thing. We don't hear about recalls or outbreaks until after there is significant public health impact. Essentially, we don't call outbreaks until and recalls or one or the other until people are already harmed. So it's not like we do testing to prevent this stuff to get out before it gets to the stores or to the restaurants. We do, but there's always a delay. But typically, again, you almost never hear about a recall or outbreak until after someone's already been hurt, harmed, hospitalized, so, or even killed.
As you say that, I'm thinking, and this is going to be a big, long question. I hope it doesn't catch you in an area that you're not familiar with. But we always hear about, we talk about Chinese cranes when it relates to the Trojan horses and what happens at the ports. When it comes to the food safety in the country, that really is a element of national security, is it not?
Oh, definitely. We don't have to go too far. Last year, if you recall, there was an issue with heavy metals in applesauce, and it turned out that it was imported cinnamon that was heavily contaminated with lead. And this is like a food fraud issue in which lead, or essentially like lead rust, was used to supplement cinnamon and make it look like there was more without actually having the cinnamon. So when there's opportunity for economic gain, we see this from other countries. We see this even from within the United States. But when we see problems like this, where there is fraud or crime or just the opportunity where there are food items or ingredients that are not at the same level of safety that come to our borders at various ports, obviously international ports, it becomes problematic. Because when we want to have, you know, more convenient, ready-to-eat foods, commercially packaged goods, you know, and we're not buying, you know, a raw produce or raw meat kind of a thing, we're buying a, you know, something that's frozen, it's already made kind of a deal, we are making a significant assumption that the, not only has the company behind the label done their due diligence, but wherever they get their ingredients from, of course, they're going to buy from buy low, right? The cheapest person they can buy from. That's typically more and more from outside of the United States. This becomes more problematic for us in terms of the level of, and the challenge, if you will, in terms of the difficulty of making sure our food is safe.
So you're going to augment cinnamon, and you don't pick an inert ingredient. You pick rusty metal because it looks like cinnamon. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
This kind of thing happens a great deal at the time where there's foods that are supplemented with different things. You know, you can go back into America's history and look at when chalk has been added to milk or when other things have been added to food or when food, it says it's from here, but it's actually from a different location, or it says that it's this kind of fish. We see this a lot. It says that it's this kind of fish, but it's actually some other cheaper kind of a fish that's more readily available. So there is not just food safety issues, but there's food security and authenticity issues at play as well. Again, leading to the level of difficulty in terms of how do we regulate food within the United States.
So when you talk about that cinnamon incident and others like it, how would the United States even go about checking what was coming into the country from other countries? Because you can't check every bottle that comes in. I guess you can either rely on the country from which it is imported, or does the United States have inspectors that go over there and look at the plants?
This is one of those things where if it was a multiple choice question, the answer would be D, all of the above.
Okay.
I know some companies that not only are you looking at the fact that the FDA has gone over to that country and has evaluated their food safety standards and kind of rated them and have helped them rated, as in given them a rating in terms of how well they align with U.S. standards. They'll go over, there are agencies and universities that will go over to other countries and help. I've done some of this work where we go over and help other countries with their food standards and their food training. But then you have companies that literally they will send people over there to do independent testing of the farms, of the factories, of the processing in other countries before it's even shipped over to the United States. And then at the U.S. border, there'll be inspections to make sure that the paperwork and the auditing and inspection is done there. And then when it gets from the border to the actual company, like, you know, again, to take that, let's use the example of the cinnamon, to use the cinnamon and now make the applesauce with the cinnamon in it, they'll do yet another round of testing. So, you know, whether you call it redundant or just multi-levels of scaffolded testing and auditing and inspection, that is what the American consumer assumes takes place when these things go on. When we hear about the cost of food rising, we think it's because of these multiple interventions and inspections and audits and testings at different points to make sure that at every level there is that transparency. We hear the word transparency a lot these days. There is that transparency all along food's journey to make sure that it truly is as safe and as described on its label.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back and we'll talk about, you know, Professor, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking of a prison guard that goes home at night and he catches eight guys going over the wall and he's feeling pretty good about himself. But then right as he falls asleep, he gets to thinking, wait a minute, what about the others I didn't catch? What about the 15 I didn't catch? We'll talk about the stuff that gets through that doesn't get detected. Darren Detweiler, our guest, associate teaching professor at Northeastern University, he's an author, professor at Northeastern, about food safety, what the government does, how the whole system works, about food recalls, food poisoning, food safety, food security. Any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. And I would also like to ask when we come back how subject is our food supply to foreign manipulation. 920, Tommy Tucker, back in a flash, WWL. Interesting conversation, as always, with Darren Detweiler, associate teaching professor at Northeastern University. Professor, in a nutshell, tell people what it is you do.
So as a professor, I focus on not only regulatory compliance, but I teach courses like global economics of food and agriculture and corporate social responsibility. But this parallels the work that I do as an author and an advisor. I advise many companies and governments. I sit on various advisory boards. I currently sit on an FDA advisory board and a CDC work group, but I've worked with the National Environmental Health Association. In the past, I've served in various capacities as an advisor for the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. USDA, excuse me, as well, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And basically for 3 decades, I've been working in this kind of capacity where I represent the consumer perspective. I do this whether it's on, you know, boards or advisory committees or sometimes on stage and in print and even in documentaries like the Netflix documentary Poisoned, The Dirty Truth About Your Food, that just won an Emmy, which in itself is awesome that a documentary about food safety and the issues that we're dealing with in terms of the complexity of our food system was made and won an Emmy.
Tell me about that Emmy-winning film on Netflix, which I'll do my best to watch. But what is it that you uncovered? What are some of the takeaways from that?
Well, first, it looked at this idea that when we say America has the safest food supply in the world, what does this really mean, and why is it that most leading experts kind of laugh at that statement? Because it's not used as a statement that says we have to uphold this standard. It's kind of used by policymakers and too many executives and policymakers as an excuse for us not to do more. Like, we don't have to have better regulation, better policies, because we already have the safest. But do we have the safest? Because essentially, one of the things I talked about is that for almost 3 decades now, we've held on to the fact that some 48 million Americans get sick, 128,000 are hospitalized, and some 3,000 people die due to failures in food safety in America every single year. that's equivalent to having a 9/11 worth of lost lives every year due to failures in our food supply. And the thing is that this number has not changed. It has not improved by even 1%. So whereas the optimist in me says, well, you know what, it's become more and more complex. Our food supply, our food system has become more and more complex. Perhaps the work that's gone in terms of science and technology and policy and the Herculean efforts of so many people within the food industry and within food regulatory agencies have kept it at bay, it still begs the question, why have we not improved these numbers even 1% in the last three decades?
I watched the documentary Fed Up, and it changed my life in terms of sugar and the way I eat. And I'm concerned with watching this, Professor, because I'm afraid I'm not going to eat anything else ever again.
Well, you know, at the end, I am asked I'm in like 35% of the movie. I was a technical consultant, and it's part of the content is based on my first book. And I talk about what happened 30 years ago that was considered to be the landmark event that kicked off our current era of food safety. But at the very end, I'm asked, what are the foods that I personally avoid? And I list those. And there's people who's like, that's crazy. Why do you avoid those foods? But then they're like, wait a minute. When the movie came out in 2023, that fall, all three of those foods that I listed were in the middle of huge outbreaks and recalls.
So what are they?
I don't eat cantaloupe, and people are always scratching their head about.
You're talking about cut prepackaged at the grocery store or just in general?
I don't eat any cantaloupe at all.
Okay.
Cantaloupe is, you cannot adequately clean the outside, and it has a pH balance inside that is, the pH inside it really supports the growth, the rapid growth of pathogens. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the idea of how many deaths, and this is, most people aren't even aware of this. There was an outbreak tied to cantaloupe a while back. 33 people were killed. There was another more recent outbreak where, again, more people were killed because of cantaloupe and how contaminated it was on the inside when you bring that knife through it. The largest number of people, I think, in the U.S., from any one contaminated food was because of cantaloupe. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, if you save leftovers in your refrigerator, it increases the odds for the pathogens to grow. And I would recommend if you really want to eat cantaloupe, don't save any leftovers, kind of a thing. I also just personally, my decision is I don't eat cantaloupe. The second thing is bagged lettuce. You know, we see these kind of convenient options where you have different mixes of leafy greens. The amount of recalls and outbreaks we've had over the last decade from leafy greens has been just ridiculous. You know, you can buy a head of lettuce and you get one item from one place. But when you're buying some of these bags of mixed lettuce, you're getting multiple heads and sometimes from multiple places even. And if it's not cleaned properly, because we don't cook salads, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have what's called a kill step. And the number of people that get sick from bagged lettuce every year is incredible. And the third item is traditional sprouts. I don't know if people are paying attention to this, but most major retailers stopped selling sprouts because of how many times it's being recalled year after year after year. Even Jimmy John's, famous for their sandwiches, one of their major popular ingredients has been sprouts, and they kept having to take it off because they kept having people getting sick from their sprouts because they were contaminated. And then they would put it back on the menu because people demanded it, and then they would take it off the menu because people got sick. And year after year was this continuous battle with sprouts. Now, I've learned that there's a new way of making sprouts. I actually went to a sprout company in the San Francisco area and saw how traditional sprouts were made and why they're always contaminated, because basically they're just continuously watered at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, mm-hmm. and it allows for the pathogens to grow and to spread. Whereas there's a new modern way of growing sprouts that the entire operation takes place below 41 degrees, that making it impossible for pathogens to grow. And these are actually allowed back into stores now. You can buy them, kind of a thing. It sounds like I'm giving a commercial here. The point being is that there are ways in which science and technology and policy are making an impact. We can see it here with the sprouts. They figured out a different way to make the sprouts. or the decisions you can make. Again, like making decisions to consume or how to consume a bagged lettuce or cantaloupe. So a lot of it is information or personal decision, in addition to the policies and the science and technology that is being used to make our food even safer.
How dependent is the United States on foreign countries for our food supply and the safety of food that we eat?
That's a great question. It's a growing amount. You know that like over 50% of our fresh fruit comes from, through U.S. imports from other countries. Mm-hmm. And 90% of our seafood, right? So, you know, when food is grown or processed or packaged overseas, the U.S. has less direct control over how it's handled. Think about it. We have thousands of ports of entry and millions of shipments of food, yet the FDA inspects less than 2% of imported food shipments. And we've now been pushing for the last 14 years for stronger preventive controls and supply, foreign supplier verification that can verify the suppliers, and there's auditing of these farms, and it can help us respond more quickly to this. Because again, it's just not possible to inspect everything. So we rely on this trust. We rely on the paperwork. We rely on the spot checks, kind of like that redundancy you were talking about earlier, to catch when our system is more vulnerable to these intentional fraud or even unintentional lapses in food safety. Because the reality is, you know, you go to a restaurant, you go to a grocery store, and you're thinking like, oh, this is an American brand, American company kind of a deal, right? But we have ingredients from India. There's processing of food in China. There's packaging of food in Mexico, and it matters more and more in terms of the idea that the more hands through which food passes, there's more chances for contamination, for mishandling, and even for false documentation. So you start looking at these issues, and what are we dealing with right now? We have countries with weaker economies, that we have examples of where there are corners being cut to meet demand or reduce costs. When we have trade negotiations, which we've been talking about for the last couple months here, a more volatile trade situation between countries, these sometimes deprioritize safety in favor of volume and speed. And of course, we have mislabeling and other things that ultimately, this economic pressure in other countries literally incentivizes cheaper and riskier practices, and without any kind of stronger global enforcement or consequences, unsafe practices thrive, but ultimately the most vulnerable, those who are very young, like under 5 years of age, our elderly, those who are pregnant, those who are immunocompromised, those are the ones who suffer the most consequences.
We're going to take a break. We have Steve Nelson coming up. Professor, thank you for your time. The name of the Emmy Award-winning documentary on Netflix is Poison, The Dirty Truth About Your Food. I guess watcher beware, but it gives you some information you need to know. I appreciate your time and your efforts, Professor. I really do. Darren Detweiler, Associate Teaching Professor at Northeastern University. We'll talk to you again soon. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, they got another threat for some weather today that could affect us. We'll talk with Steve Nelson, who is the General Superintendent of the Sewage and Water Board, when we return. Right now, traffic, WWL. Hi, 9:45, quarter till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Another rainy afternoon forecast. Steve Nelson joins us now, our friend, General Superintendent of the Sewage and Water Board. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing well, Tommy. Thank you.
Tell me what's going on over there. Is Ghassan still in charge, or are you running the place?
Ghassan's in charge until May 2nd will be his last day with the board.
And then what happens? Do we know?
The board's in the process of a national search for a replacement. I expect they'll be making a decision shortly.
Did you put your name in that hat or not?
The board is working hard to vet through. They had over 70, actually just about 70 applicants, so a lot of folks interested in the job, and I think that's a testament to the job that Ghassan has done in getting the board ready and in a position to succeed going forward.
And were you one of them or not?
I did put my hat in the ring,
okay.
And I know there were a lot of really qualified candidates, so it's an honor to serve in any capacity.
I was just curious. I was just wondering. Tell me about, the dashboard and pumping and power that people can look at. Because, you know, first of all, let me take a step back. Steve, what happened yesterday in Algiers and Ninth Ward? Where did Orleans Parish have problems?
Yeah, so the primary issues that I've heard about, I've seen reports of water on the street in the French Quarter, the CBD, and we did take 6 to 7 inches of water in those areas over the course of a couple of hours. The bulk of the rain, though, fell on Algiers Point and then the lower Ninth Ward, and I've seen some reports of almost 10 inches of rain over the course of 4 to 6 hours, which is a storm that happens statistically between 1 in 50 and 1 in 100 years, so really uncommon levels of rain in a very short period of time. And when your system is set up to take an inch an hour, if you're taking 2, 3, 4 inches in an hour and doing that over multiple hours, it's going to overwhelm your capacity.
It seems like when you talk about those numbers with the statistical probability, boy, it just seems like we're getting a lot more rain a lot more frequently. Is that accurate or is it just perception?
Yeah, statistically, what I have seen is that on average, we get about the same amount of rain in a given year, which is between 60 and 65 inches, which is a lot. What we have seen in the last decade or so is that that rain is falling in shorter increments. So instead of getting it spread out over the course of 8, 10, 12 hours, we're getting it in the space of 2, 3, and 4.
So I saw somebody interviewed yesterday, and look, God bless them. I know it's frustrating when the streets flood or when somebody's car floods or, God forbid, it gets into their homes, and they say, you know, there's enough. They got to do something. Something's got to be done, and I empathize with that person. I really do. But when you get 10 inches of rain in a short period of time, there is nothing you can do ever in this area, is there?
Well, anything's doable with a long enough lever. The question just becomes, is there enough funding and enough time to be able to make it happen? And the first thing that I look at when we get reports of flooding is I look at the street level, and then I look at the elevation of the canal at our pump station, and that will tell me if the issue is with our pumps, with our canals, or with our catch basins and small lines. And what we saw yesterday in Algiers and the lower Ninth Ward and every place I did some drive arounds is that the level of rain that we got did not overwhelm our pumps, but it was certainly more than the catch basins, the laterals, and in Algiers' case, you know, the canals could handle. And so, you know, at this point, the system is not designed to handle that level of rain. But in order to be able to do that, yes, it does require a lot of investment, in particular on the federal level. To offer a little bit of hope, the Algiers area, the CELA program, which the Army Corps has been helping fund that program since the 90s, does have a project on that General de Gaulle, the canal down to Gaulle, that I think will help alleviate some of these things in the future. But to your point, a 1-in-100-year storm is not something we're set up for right now.
Yeah, I should have said anything. A contractor will tell you anything can be done if you have the money. I can do anything you want. I'll put a swimming pool on your ceiling if you want. Sure, if you got the money, we can do it. When it comes to preparation for a day like today, which is, it might be a day like yesterday. What do you do in advance of that, Steve, to make sure that everything's ready and pumping as much as they possibly can?
Yeah, absolutely. The things that we do in advance is make sure that we've got the proper amount of staffing. We make sure that we've got the proper turbines up and running, which turbine 5 is up and running right now. We've got staff at the stations, and we're pumping down the canals to make sure they're as empty as possible so that we can take as much rain as we can in a given shot.
So when I'm looking at this dashboard, and it tells me, help us to navigate this dashboard if you can, although it's radio and there aren't pictures. It tells me about the pumps that are working. It tells me about the turbines that are online. Tell me how to read this thing. Turbine 5 and 6 are online. 4 is available.
Yes, and 5 and 6 are the turbines that we're going to rely on for a situation like today, and the EMDs as well. Turbine 4 is a really old piece of equipment. It takes about 3 hours to get heated up. So unless I know, and once it's hot, I have to have a load for it. So it's a piece of equipment that I really can only use if I know exactly when and where it's going to rain, which we don't have that granularity today. So we're going to rely on turbines 5 and 6 and the EMDs and then our frequency changers today. And that should be ample power to power those pumps that we need to power.
EMDs are?
Yeah, the EMDs, I'm sorry, they're converted diesel locomotive engines. Mm-hmm. So they produce the flavor of power that we need. And we've talked about this power complex project. That's going to start coming online here end of June, first week of July. We'll have brand new equipment that will start replacing these old turbines and EMDs. Now, it's not going to be a panacea. If you get 10 inches of rain and that canal level's below the street level, you got to start with the catch basins, the laterals, and the canals. Going through that dashboard, you can see the amount of power available. When it's in green, we know we've got ample power, the number of major pumps available. The vast majority of our major drainage pumps are up and running. We do have one pump that's on standby emergency service for Algiers. We have one pump we have three pumps that are out in New Orleans East, but those have redundancy built into the systems so that we should be able to handle that 1 inch an hour. Again, if it falls more than an inch in an hour, we're going to start to see water pond in the street, and then the mission moves towards getting it off the street. The next kind of page down that you can see as you scroll down that page is a real-time depiction of which pump stations have pumps running. Mm-hmm. So when the dots on that map are green, it says that we've got pumps ready to run. And when they switch to blue, you can see that they're running. So looking at it right now, I can see that we've got pumps, especially in New Orleans East, where we're pulling those canals down. I know because I've got real-time data on where the canals are that we've got the canals low in the older part of the city and on the West Bank.
And I don't see any. I don't see any out of service, do I?
When you look not on that dashboard, when you click on the equipment status, there's a blue bar there. You can see which pumps are out where. And as I mentioned, we've got one serving Algiers that's available for emergency use. And then we have one at Station 14, which is out in New Orleans East, that is out of service. But then that station is connected by the Morrison Canal to two others. And within that station, we got four pumps that provide redundant capacity.
So real quick, where would you least like to see it rain today, Steve?
Well, New Orleans East is actually our most storm-ready area. That Morrison Canal, when it was initially designed, has a lot of redundancy built into it. Where we typically have problems is, and folks will generally know this, is the Lakeview area, parts of Mid-City, Gentilly. If it drops, five, six, 7 inches over the course of 1, 2, or 3 hours, that's when things start to stack up.
When it comes to the water's got to get into the system for it to be pumped out, right? So when it comes to oak leaves and all of the stuff that's clogging up the drains and clearing of drains, I know that's public works, but how concerned are you with just the oak leaves and things that just happen? I mean, it just happens.
Well, the system is all of its parts together, so it's easy to focus on a pump or a power component, but it starts at the street level, and it starts with things that I can do at my house. If I blow my grass clippings into the yard and not into the street, if I pick up trash off the side of the street, if I pick up the leaves, that's debris that can end up in the catch basins, and that's all stuff that we as individuals can do. And then once it gets into the catch basin, we got to be able to clear it out. And so as of January, the Sewerage and Water Board has taken over that small diameter system. And so what we're working towards is that goal of being able to clean 20% of the system every year, which means you'll clean all of it once in every five. Now, that doesn't mean you'll hit everything every 5 years. Some areas where you've got heavier tree canopy, we're going to want to hit that every single year. But that does require funding, which the state and the city have been helpful in getting us launched on that. So this year we're standing that up. And then from there, it's got to get into the canals, and then from there, it's got to get to the pump stations. And this is where, with the larger projects, so it starts with the catch basins, us cleaning catch basins and laterals, then to the canals, and we've got to maintain those. But there's also a program that the Army Corps has funded, the SELA program, since the 90s, which actually has a project going on the West Bank in Algiers right now to increase the size of that canal.
Got to run, Steve.
The water, yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate the information. I really do hope you come back. Quick break. Back in a flash, WWL.